Today is August 25th, 2019. You're listening to Fancy Ramen. I'm Neil.
And I'm Scott.
Today we cover Bloodborne.
We talk about...
telling lies.
Telling lies. We cover a little bit of Suikoden 5 and Neil's completion. And delve just a little bit into a preview of Final Fantasy Tactics, which will be Neil's next Let's Play.
Cookie is out for the week. I believe he gets back in 2 weeks or next week.
He might be back next week. No, he is doing that hosting thing. So maybe a break on this upcoming week because I'll be out of the country.
Or it might be just a long soliloquy.
And that would be
phenomenal.
When
you say hosting, let's also confirm that he is a host in a cabaret club.
That's right. I didn't want anybody to get the wrong impression that he was doing some sort of like charity work.
So that means that he gets dressed up in a nice suit and then he's evaluated based on his stats, like sexy, cute, funny, and I don't remember the fourth one. Sexy, cute, funny, and beauty.
How beautiful he is. Sexy and beauty being two completely separate statistics.
They are. And then he engages with customers and gets them to buy expensive drinks. And he essentially pretends to be like a boyfriend or something like that. But like no physical touching.
Right. Just direct and constant emotional support.
Exactly. All on this episode of Fancy Ramen 130, title pending. I stole a piece of Tiff's Honeycrisp apple.
Ah, yum. Is it good or is it one of those Honeycrisps that's swollen to like three times its size and tastes like water in apple form?
This one has like the acidity that an apple normally does, not like super strong, but it doesn't really have the sweetness of it. So
yeah, that's what I really dislike is when those Honeycrisps don't have any of the actual honey kind of flavor that should be associated with them.
In which case, it's just a crisp apple.
Yeah. I mean, I get the joke, but it's actually 100% true, too. You just get the sharpness and nothing else.
This is a week, an episode, a whatever, where I...
This is going to be a week episode, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, because we're not talking about Three Houses at all.
Right. I haven't finished my New Game Plus playthrough, and I probably won't have it done until two podcasts out from now, considering my vacation. So there's nothing to delve into on my side, and I assume you've been so demoralized by playing as a blue lion that it's over for you.
It's actually gotten better. It's just that I feel like we can let it rest until we actually are doing like a spoiler cast of it on it.
Agreed.
So I'm glad that has been established. So what else have you been doing this week?
I have been pulled back into the world of Bloodborne.
As you should be.
Yeah. I mean, a variety of factors got me back into it. But most of it is being the primary taste maker in my workplace. And that is recommending all of the best games and shows to watch and distributing that, you know, sacred knowledge to anyone who will listen or who is unfortunately within earshot of my opinion. And I'm like happy to say that I've probably gotten at least three people each to pick up a From Software game, Dark Souls 3, Bloodborne, and Sekiro, respectively. I loaned out Sekiro, and that's a single player game, so there's no playing any sort of online with that person. The other person who I got into Dark Souls is Xbox, and so I don't have the same hardware to connect, and I am almost certain that there's no crossplay on that. And so the last coworker and friend that I got into it got into Bloodborne and picked that up. And because it's, I think, $20 for the Platinum Edition on the PlayStation Store, that is the one option that I can play online. And I haven't played with them yet, but as soon as I booted up the game, I kind of got hooked back into it. You know, your mind starts racing with the new build path you're going to try, because last time, I think, as I spoke on the podcast, I found that the Tenitrous and Strength Arcane build is truly game-breaking at certain points. And so I decided to take the entire opposite combo build and try and work out a Dex Blood Tinge character. And it's been hard, but incredibly motivating to just kind of like push through.
Is Blood Tinge like the sole modifier that determines how strong the blood cannon is, or the hand cannon?
For all of the firearm, I think, let's call them firearm weapons, although maybe some of them aren't necessarily firearms, Blood Tinge is the scaling stat, as well as, I think, visceral attacks. So counters are also impacted by Blood Tinge. I've noticed that my visceral attacks are way more potent than they have ever been in any other Bloodborne playthrough. So countering is like massively incentivized by the fact that, one, you're doing more damage with your countering weapon anyway, and two, if you can successfully execute the counter with a visceral attack, you are going to do a massive amount of damage. And although for some bosses it's troublesome or near impossible, for common enemies it is a really like massive change to the playstyle. I don't have weapons that can stagger, but if I can counter who needs to stagger and score some free hits when I can just like pull 500 damage out of, you know, a like staggered enemy's chest.
I think the incentive is that once you get the hand cannon, that becomes your boss weapon. I actually don't know if that's strong enough, but...
But you need your strength like close to 30 to there's a cannon that you literally hold in one hand, and then there's a cannon that apparently you like wheel around with you or something. And both of those are like minimum stat of 28 strength or something, and then 30 strength for the other.
So are you not going to build high enough to use those weapons?
I mean, when we're talking about that many points invested into a strength stat that for my character I think is 10, it's a long path. That same amount of investment could put me at Blood Tinge of like 40, and then I can use the Chikage and just do blood damage with my weapon.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So I'm gonna try that. I'm gonna try mixing with the Dex and Blood Tinge. The one thing I've really noticed about this game is strength weapons are way more abundant in the like beginning and mid game than good Dex weapons. The good Dex weapons seem to be like only appearing at mid game or later.
Is the spear, the rifle spear, a Dex weapon?
The rifle spear is a Dex weapon, and you can acquire that probably the earliest out of any of the Dex weapons that aren't the threaded cane. Oh, the saw spear too, but the saw spear is a D scaling in dexterity, so it's not like it's all that good for dex builds in the first place. That, the cane is a B after upgrading it like three times, but the cane is significantly weaker than almost any of the other weapons, and so unless you have a really high dex stat, that scaling doesn't make up for the weaker base damage.
I've always felt like the cane was just self-imposed hard mode.
It's very difficult unless you're using it for crowd control. But even then, if you're crowd control in, say, a tight corridor, you're more likely to bounce the attack off the walls than hit an enemy, which is, asking to be punished by a mob.
I could be wrong, but like in its transformed, in like the transformed mode or like the trick mode, which for people that haven't played Bloodborne, your cane is basically an Ivy sword, Ivy from Soul Calibur.
Exactly.
So when you're in that trick mode, the chain cane mode, I feel like the attack windup is significantly longer than other weapons you get later that have better or equal range. Like the rifle spear, for instance, has like a relatively short windup for the amount of reach and range you get.
Agreed, absolutely. And so, and I think maybe the stamina cost is a little less for like those stabbing weapons. And so theoretically, you can be more efficient with that stamina usage.
I honestly forgot there was even stamina because of Sekiro.
Oh, yeah, that's right. No, stamina is still super important. No doubt about that. Yeah, Sekiro removing the stamina system is such a weird like change to how you mentally approach the other games. Instead of, you know, managing a resource for mostly offensive and defensive, I guess, offensive and defensive investment, you have a strictly defensive investment with your posture bar, and you're also impacting your enemy's health and their posture bar, which is the first time that an enemy or bosses like really have stamina in the same way. And it definitely it gives a completely different balance to the game that I'm not experiencing with Bloodborne or ever experienced with Dark Souls. And maybe the other argument is too that it is nice in balancing in the same way that Bloodborne has flaws when you fight other hunters who have infinite ammo on, like, say, spread weapons. So when you're fighting the hunter with the rifle spear, he can fire endlessly at you from a distance and eat up all your stamina with just trying to dodge those shots.
I think we've talked about it before, but those opposing hunters are literally like the hardest enemies in that game to some respect.
I would say undoubtedly the larger monsters are much less threatening than some of the hunters with just unlimited bullets in their ranged weapons and equal speed and rally potential to your character.
One of the first ones you face, I could be wrong, I think it's one of the first ones, is the cane, the trick cane, or what is that cane called again?
It is called the trick cane.
Or wait, no, the cane whip? Is it trick cane?
I'm pretty sure it's called the trick cane.
In any case, that has that weapon uses whatever you call the magic in Bloodborne in the church. Is it, no, or is it Bergenworth?
Maybe. I haven't gotten to Bergenworth yet on this playthrough, so I don't remember. Threaded cane, not
threaded
cane.
Yeah, that.
I thought I'd double check. Yeah, it is in Bergenworth. I remember now, and I guess there is one there. There may be another threaded cane user in Yosefka's clinic, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember exactly. That was a game that like I went through it. I got through it. I don't necessarily feel a strong desire to replay anytime soon. Like I have before, but it already made its point. It's already been great. I think the only reason I'd ever pick it back up is to go through the Chalice Dungeons finally and the DLC, which I still hadn't done.
Oh, you do need to play that. And the Chalice Dungeons, I wouldn't bother because they're honestly an expression of one of the few things that is bad about the game is contrasting the Chalice Dungeons to the like well-detailed and thought-out design of the levels in the, what would we say, the story and the game at large. Like the Chalice Dungeons being this weird roguelike procedurally generated area just actually shows how like terrible this game would be if the environments were more formulaic and less handcrafted.
Right. I mean, I think the Chalice Dungeons are great to for multiplayer and for people that just really enjoy the combat,
mm-hmm.
The gameplay itself, you know. Regardless, though, I'm glad you picked it back up again. You actually, it wasn't that long ago when you played it the first time, right?
It's been approximately a year. And I honestly wasn't sure if I'd play it again. I told that coworker, like, oh, I'll play with you, thinking I can create a new character, kind of get them started and, you know, like it help them start their journey in the game. And then kind of once the training wheels are off, let them progress through. But if anything, what's happened is I've booted up the game and thought, there's another way to play this that I haven't done yet. And I am just so excited to have, I don't know, another challenging experience from one of these games. And I'm so drawn in by the setting in this particular game compared to, say, ever playing Dark Souls 1, 2, or 3 again, that I'm pretty sure I've like doubled the amount of time and levels that he's put into the game since recommending it more than a week ago. I actually had to check in and I'm like, I need to know your level to make sure that I haven't overshot the summoning like range that you can pull me into the game, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't like over leveled for him to pull me in at this point.
Have you gotten far enough in where there's PvP?
So I haven't done any PvP yet. This is actually my first time playing it online too, and it's much better online. As much as I enjoyed the individual experience playing it last year before I got PlayStation Plus, just the notes are incredibly fun and helpful, and it's a nice reminder being back in the game for where some ambushes may be, or to read the notes that I know are obvious traps to get you to die. Sure. So it's nice to have that, but I haven't had any PvP because I think in this game, the PvP is initiated after you've summoned a helper. And every time I've tried to summon an online player for help, I've wasted the insight and nobody has shown up. And I've just gone about my thing anyway. The last time I tried to summon someone was at Dark Beast Parl, and nobody came. And so I went into the Dark Beast Parl fight alone instead of summoning an old hunter, because I had already wasted one insight. And I beat it without anybody. So I decided that maybe I'll save my insight for just buying items at the fountain. And I'll save the madman's knowledge to drop to my friend so he can summon me in when he needs help. That's maybe the other thing that's kind of fun, is guiding someone around a world or a game that you know very well. I'm finally at the point in a From Software game where I get to be the like friendly phantom or spirit that steps in and drops like a late game item for somebody to use.
Do you foresee yourself like going into each boss with them, or...
I don't know. It'll be whatever he needs. And I think a lot of these bosses are, some of them are honestly more manageable alone. I realize that Dark Beast Parl, for instance, is actually an easier fight individually because it moves fast enough that, and the tracking on him is difficult, that the more characters there are for him to target or lock onto, actually the less telegraphed or easy to read his moves become, and the more likely you're going to get hit by a surprise like sweeping claw attack, versus if you're facing him one-on-one, he's relatively transparent, and if you time your dodges right, you can finish the fight very quickly.
I can see that there are
I definitely think cooperation is sometimes detrimental.
It would be cool if, well, no, I don't know if the game necessarily needs it because of that reason, but I was wondering if it'd be cool if there were a mode where summoning help essentially made bosses harder. Kind of like Cuphead, if you want to think of it that way.
Or what's the Monster Hunter, where monsters have like a scaling of health and I think damage output based on how many people are on a mission. That would be cool, actually. I wouldn't be against that. There are some bosses that it definitely makes sense for, and others where I'm sure even an extra couple like 100 ticks of health would make me want to pull my hair out. So the balancing may be a little tricky. But yeah, I'm trying to think. There's nothing else notable about Bloodborne at this point. I mean, I've described in great detail already my transition from enjoying the game to thinking it's a masterpiece to acknowledging that although Dark Souls is what got me into From Software games, I'm actually much more sold on their more recent IPs that they've developed, like Bloodborne and Sekiro.
Right.
And I think, I don't think I shared it with you earlier, but I definitely think that Bloodborne does condition players to play all of the From Software games until Sekiro, probably, in a more entertaining way by, you know, removing the shield and making the items, the weapons at least, much more like offensively oriented. So you're doing a lot more attacking and dodging and much less like defending and poking. And then I guess the rally mechanic being introduced, we've definitely spoken about this, how the rally mechanic is actually a way to press you back into the fight as opposed to back off and chug Estus.
Yeah, yeah.
Sekiro is interesting in the sense that like, in order to keep your, like, it still uses that while being a defensively oriented game by forcing you to continue to engage your enemy so their posture bar doesn't replenish. And it's very cool and interesting how they essentially do the opposite of Bloodborne and promote you pressing an attack or remaining like in the face of your opponent by actively trying to whittle down their defense as opposed to trying to rebound or recover, say, your health and keep the offensive up that way. It's just funny how they use two very different mechanics to execute the same, to incentivize the same kind of player behavior, and that both are so much fun and I think promote a more active gameplay style to the game than the sword and board techniques that I thought were the bread and butter to beating From Software games beforehand.
In some way, unless you were doing like your glass cannon builds, I'd almost even say that like that was the efficient way to play Dark Souls.
The sword and board or the...
I mean, not talking about efficient in terms of like a time standpoint, because obviously going glass cannon and just memorizing movesets is the ideal.
Incredibly fast, yeah.
But like the way that the game seems to be intended to play is very sword and board. Bloodborne in particular was a conscious design to get away from that.
Mm-hmm. That's it for Bloodborne, Neil. I don't know if you've picked up anything new to game on or if you've been locked in to Fire Emblem.
So I picked up a new release, brand new, day of, or maybe day after, called Telling Lies, which is the second game by, I believe his name is Sam Bartlow. He was the guy that was responsible for Her Story, a game that took on a lot of real life footage and used essentially a type of interface in order to explain its use and to justify its use. In Her Story, you were playing as a character that you weren't entirely sure who exactly it was that you were playing as, going through a catalog or an archive of police interrogation videos regarding a murder. I don't need to speak about spoilers and so forth. I might have even talked about it on the podcast. I don't know if this was if this predates Fancy Ramen.
No, we've definitely spoken about Her Story, because I think shortly after we started the podcast, at least shortly after I joined, so in the very early episodes, I had encountered the game for the first time.
Gotcha.
And so I think you'd spoken about it a bit. I don't think we've spoiled it yet, and since it is a game that would lose, I think, a lot of motivation for players if they did know the twist. I think it would be a good idea for us to...
Yeah,
it's spoiler free.
It's not like we're talking about Metal Gear Solid 5 or Silent Hill, you know, 1-3 or anything like that, where it's a game that obviously there's a lot built upon the twist or the catch, but the
story doesn't matter at all.
Well, but those games are like extremely popular, and if you haven't played it at this point, you're kind of putting yourself up to get spoiled at some point in time if you haven't already been. And so Her Story on the other side, I'm sure there are still a bunch of people that don't even know it exists. So this new game is called Telling Lies, and it takes on a very similar point we'll say mechanics, which is you are essentially going through video logs or like an archive of videos, and eventually you figure out the greater meaning of the story as a result of seeking out videos using keywords, which essentially are searching the script of each video, the dialogue of each video. And that's kind of the basis of it. Now, the biggest differences between the two games, I would say, is, for one, is centered around that this game is essentially about going through NSA or FBI like logs that were recorded essentially using one I guess you could say it was like surveillance or chat logs from one person and all of his communications to other people. So if this main character that we'll call David spoke to someone named Emma, that means that you would have both his side and her side of the conversation. But the twist kind of comes from the standpoint that if you are not necessarily privy to one person says, you might not know exactly how to get the other side of the conversation. So if I find one piece of one conversation where he's talking about, I don't know, he's talking about wanting a package delivered, and he's referring to the reason for the delivery as a party. He needs a package for this party, which obviously is like code for something. You need to come up with a way that you can find out anything that the other person might have said in order to find his half of the conversation. And so the other person may not say or mention package or party. So you have to start looking for other clues in the first half of the conversation that would cue you in or give you a keyword to the other half. Whereas in her story, it's all one side of the interrogation process. You never actually hear the questions. So you are just looking for keywords that one particular character gives you and, you know, search through there. In addition to that, Telling Lies gives you like a much better idea of what the situation is as you're going through the videos. In her story, it's just you sat down to a computer and like as you play through the game, you get emails or like texts or something that cue you in on who you are as the person going through these files and what your purpose is. But this game starts off with essentially a video of a woman getting out of what looks like an Uber or taxi, going into her apartment and jumping on a computer. And then there's text files on the computer because you're essentially controlling a laptop, if you will. There are text files on this computer that are basically implying that, hey, Karen, me being you, the player, like these files are hot. Like, you know, you realize they're going to come after you once they find where you are. So it gives you a sense of like urgency in helping this person that you're playing as figure out the truth of the nature of the game and the story. I've seen a lot of people like compare this game to Her Story. And like, I would personally say that I think the payoff in Her Story is definitely better. I really do like the execution of Telling Lies or in comparison, the fact that it gives you more a sense of urgency, whereas in Her Story, it felt like, you know, you were just kind of looking at things through your own like warrant and merit. Like if you didn't want to continue, you could stop and so forth. And this game at least had like shedded a degree of I go back to the word urgency, despite it being an illusion, as I would later find out. That really there was no time limit, and you could just keep looking at videos and rewatching videos, and the clock on the computer would never go past a certain point, which seemed to be around 6 a.m. So Which that is, I regret to say, that's probably a bit of a spoiler. So I'll probably throw a minor spoiler tag. But it is nice to know that you don't necessarily have to rush through things. You can actually take your time.
How fast does it feel like the clock is moving? Does it seem like until it hits that point of stasis that it's counting down in a way that like makes you feel very panicked or rushed to get through the content?
It kind of depends, because there are a lot of conversations that do not necessarily give you extremely vital information.
Like, which is similar to her story.
Yeah. And in that case, like the stuff that doesn't necessarily matter, so to speak, although I'd argue like almost every video is probably important in some way, time doesn't pass at all.
Okay.
But, or like it might, like a minute or so might pass. So it almost feels like the time, which starts around midnight and goes until 6 a.m., I believe, is almost like a progress bar in a game that says, like, you know, you've explored 88%. But as this, you know, instead of it being progress, it's hours and minutes. But the other thing is that very specific videos that are very important or seem to imply very big things or changes to the plot are weighted more heavily. So what would ultimately happen in my case is I would start to come across some really big, juicy parts of a story. And after two or three videos, suddenly I'm like 2 hours past the point I was just at.
Mm.
And that seemed to be a pretty common thing. And then ultimately, like as I got close to the end of the game, I hit like 5 a.m. or 5:10 a.m. and then proceeded to go through maybe like a dozen videos, and it only advanced like 2-3 minutes. And it was mostly because I hadn't come across any more like quote unquote groundbreaking or like substantial, we'll say evidence or like substantial events.
You could call it a key video.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, precisely. So it feels awkward in that regard, but it did give like a cool little sense of impact when I would come across some of the big parts, some of the big, super important things that happen, so to speak. But ultimately, like it becomes pretty evident that at one point it doesn't necessarily matter how long you take. The story definitely isn't as good as her story, and it doesn't have nearly the same degrees of twists and turns. It becomes a little more predictable. Although, like, for the first hour or two of play, you definitely are thinking that there's more to it, or maybe that you're, you know, within the initial, like, gameplay, you start to set up certain expectations that end up getting twisted. But, like, by the 50% point, you're basically just watching essentially the story of one person as opposed to like a compelling drama, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was talking to Tiff about it, I found myself like wanting there to be catches and twists, and maybe like the ending could be something that is not necessarily what it seems. But like ultimately, it kind of is what it is, if that makes sense. Despite like wanting there to actually be a twist that the game is not telling us, like kind of like her story, like her story has a very ambiguous ending. You want the ending of Telling Lies to be ambiguous, or at least I do, and it really isn't, unfortunately. Aside from that, I finished Suikoden 5 on stream. And I'm kind of reminded like why I held that game in such a high regard. For essentially a series, Suikoden, of course, being a JRPG series, more or less about like nations, wars, and so forth, and like the human struggle. That series is essentially capped off with 5. They haven't made another game since 2007. Mm-hmm. And I would honestly say that it has essentially the perfect ending. Spoilers, but the good guys win. You have like a lot of really touching cutscenes where essentially the main character is sort of reunited with his dead family or his dead parents, like in a symbolic
dying?
Sort of way.
Oh,
he doesn't die. But like it's a super fairy tale ending that is really, really well done. They have music orchestrated to to match this particular scene and change with it in the same fashion that like a, you know, a cartoon or a movie would do. Like, whereas a lot of video game music is designed to just be on like a 2-minute loop.
Right.
And even then, other games that have like not necessarily loop friendly music, like Persona 4 comes to mind, the last battle. you didn't play 4, right?
I played a tiny fraction of 4. We're talking about like not making it past the first month.
So I don't need to go into it then, because you wouldn't necessarily understand. But like, there is also music in RPGs and video games that is not built to be a good loop, but it's not synced up.
Like that Juness song, for instance.
Oh, Every Day's Great at Your Juness?
Yeah, yep, that one. you hear that too many times.
But that's it. I'm going to play Final Fantasy Tactics next, which, like, in all honesty, I think is actually a better story than any of the Suikoden games. It's also more gritty, more harsh.
It doesn't have a idealistic conclusion.
Depends. So, like, this is not so much a spoiler for the game, because they kind of present it to you in this way. You're essentially opening up a new breakout record or book that's been published. Essentially, the record is saying that, like, this is the true history of what happened during this period of time that followed with a king becoming a champion of the people and having like a glorious, peaceful rule for like, I don't recall if it's like 50, 70 years. But basically, you're told that there was a king that had a really good, like a really good servants or time. He used to be a commoner. He rises up to the position of king over this over the world of Ivalice or Ivalice. I don't recall what the pronunciation is for it. And the papers that are released or published or found are apparently from a person that tried to expose the truth when the king was, like, shortly after the king was crowned and was executed for it. And the papers essentially are going to tell the true story or the full story. So that's when you enter the game proper itself, where you play as essentially someone very close to the soon-to-be king. And you start, like, the story kind of less detaches itself from like the standpoint of the author, because you don't actually meet the author until later, but you start following this character who's tangential to the future king. And you kind of, I guess, you live through this other character's life or story during this turbulent era, which is very closely modeled after the War of the Roses. And I guess the entire idea, again, looking back at like a game I played close to like 17 years ago or something, maybe more than that, 20 years ago, the story is sort of about Ramza, this tangential character, and also about seeing the soon-to-be king or the to-be king, all of the shit he does, and asking yourself at the end, is it technically worth everything he did to become king? Also knowing that his time as king was like peaceful and good and positive for the most part. At least we've been told from history, which is the whole also purpose that, like, you know, victors can write history their own way, at least, you know, during the medieval times. So it's dark within the sense of you have to kill rebels and people that, you know, have their own desires and their own
motivations.
Right. And so you're kind of on the bad side, or at least you're kind of on like a corrupt side for a while. You have to essentially see the harshness of war, the harshness of starvation and bad, like essentially like a system that doesn't work. You have to witness like the failings of like medieval life, and you also like witness essentially what becomes a revolution during the process of it. Hopefully it'll be good. I remember it being good, but I also remember, as I look back at it, that there was quite a bit of grinding and random battles, which is kind of weird for a strategy game.
Right. It's I don't know. That strikes me as such a turnoff for strategy games. It's like, I guess, how do they initiate a random encounter? You're walking on an overworld and then it drops you into a like chessboard style map.
You have all of your movement on a like hand-drawn style map with like markers designating important locations like cities, marshes, forests.
Right.
And through the course of your game, your character serves essentially kind of as like a piece on the map that you need to go from place to place depending on what your objective is, what jobs or quests, side quests you might have picked up. Mm-hmm. And every time you pass by one of the non-cities, like a marsh, a wasteland, a canyon, a field,
a dice is rolled to whether you have an encounter.
Yes.
Okay. The next question is just, is this movement, this is a movement across like nodes then, or is it full, like free form, multi-directional movement on a map space?
It's nodes. So like, I mean, it's like a prettied up version of having a menu of options. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. From moving from one city to another is moving on maybe one or two, like linear paths that can have, you know, n number of nodes between the two, but you have to travel through the nodes that are interconnected to get where you want to go.
Exactly. And
okay,
so I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but the game utilizes what is that term now? Scaling, level scaling.
Okay.
But it only utilizes it in random battles, and I think an optional dungeon, a like end game optional dungeon. So if you are level 10 and you get into a random battle, all of the enemies will be around or above level 10.
Mm-hmm.
But story battles are not scaling. So the idea is that if you hit a story battle that's too hard, you can still grind against the random encounters. And maybe it's beneficial because you can grind quicker because your random encounters are always getting stronger.
And therefore, yeah, always progressing your level up versus having to fight a bunch of minor battles with enemies not scaling.
Right.
And that makes sense. You can just assume that the bandits who accost you on the trail at level 5 are just getting pub stomped by you. So they have only the level 10 bandits are worth taking time or focusing on.
Though it's also hilarious because you'll end up like, let's say I have to fight against like an actual army of knights. But just before, like, and they're all level 10. But just before this fight, I was fighting a bunch of, you know, a bunch of fucking bandits that are all level 15.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it really matters.
And they've got better equipment for some reason too. it's the whole like Elder Scrolls dilemma where why is this like highwayman using a Daedric weapon against you at a certain point? It makes no sense.
Right. I think Skyrim or Oblivion has absolutely the worst use of scaling.
Oh, they do. They do an exceptionally poor job.
Especially when those games are like pushed to be realistic, or not realistic rather, but immersive. I feel like that's the opposite of immersion.
They're pitched as the, like, especially the Elder Scrolls games, they're pitched as the like alternative to playing an epic or a high fantasy adventure like Dungeons and Dragons. But the problem is that I think it's most appealing to casual players who haven't experienced a game that actually achieves that or comes close to it. And maybe that may actually be the most effective expression of my disdain for those games at times. Granted, all of the like holes that we can poke in these, they'll never erase the like hundreds of hours I've put into playing Oblivion and Skyrim in general. But it's definitely... I think that's one of the most noticeable elements that makes it much harder to enjoy or pick them up at this point.
Yeah, definitely. I guess to cap it off, though, I wouldn't necessarily say that that's even the worst part of Final Fantasy Tactics. And I don't know for sure because I haven't played it in like 20 years. But there are, because it's such an old, beloved game, there are like so many different hacks and versions of the ROM or like the PlayStation image that there are versions that literally let you queue or trigger random battles. Like I don't know exactly how it works. I'm assuming that either it's a menu prompt or like a button push, which is kind of cool. Because essentially, you know, these games obviously are 20 years old and game making in general has gotten much better and much more well thought out since then too. So they're like, for anyone listening that has never played before you play, you might want to look out all the different options available for Final Fantasy Tactics, be it the PlayStation version and all the different hacked versions available, or the PSP version, which has expanded content, which is predominantly one of the reasons why I'm playing this game next.
I definitely like the conceptual idea of your character then standing in the middle of the swamp and saying, anybody want some? And initiating a battle, as opposed to having to be ambushed every time they walk through a forest.
I mean, and when you think about it, it's just as realistic if you want to use the justification of like, we're going on a hunting party.
Yeah, but you're hunting for people, right?
Well, that's where I'm kind of, my memory fails me. I feel like a lot of the random encounters are actually with monsters.
They're bestial in nature.
Yeah, but I don't hold me to that. I think the majority of your human encounters are only through... Oh, I might be wrong.
This honestly reminds me a lot of Fire Emblem Sacred Stones, the more you speak of it. And they were around the same time as one another, too, I assume.
I imagine Sacred Stones a couple years after. Sacred Stones is from...
GBA. Oh, really? Wow. All right.
And then Final Fantasy Tactics, FFT. I looked up like FFT and I got Fast Fourier Transform.
Fourier Transforms are interesting. They're not relevant to video games. They may be relevant to video games.
I might have talked over you, but Final Fantasy Tactics, 1997. So.
Yeah, there we go.
Really cool job class system in the game, and that gets expanded upon in War of the Lions, the PSP remake. So if you want to write in, you can get to us at podcast@fancyramen.com.
You can watch us on our Twitch channels, www.twitch.tv/fancyramenTV, Cookie Skamilk, or our friend John at jfrayallday. And let's see, always remember to like and subscribe for the podcast or the YouTube channel if you enjoy the content we produce, and tell a friend about it. That's actually the best way to help us out, is to spread the word.
And I forgot to mention, I was supposed to say, hey, Cookie, John and Buck are getting those figures to you. Cookie? Cookie?